groaning. Faint voices laughed. The music continued. And there was something else. Barking. The dog was barking outside once again. I'm going to ignore it, he thought. All of it. I may not sleep, but I'm not getting out of bed. The music went on. The voices continued to talk and laugh festively. The dog's barking became more intense. Al rolled over and pressed his head into the mattress, pulling the pillow down over his ear. But he could still hear it, the phantom party, the persistent barking. And then he felt the familiar vibration ooze through his body, through his bones. It curled its long and bony fingers around his elbows and knees, over his shoulders and over the top of his skull, increasing its pressure, vibrating deeper and deeper. Al rolled onto his back and began to kick frantically at the blankets, his breath hissing through clenched teeth as he rolled off the bed and thunked to the floor, then crawled a few feet away from the bed before clambering to his feet. Moving backward, he bumped into the dresser, stood there, and stared at the bed. He could see nothing. There were no visible signs that the bed was filled with some kind of sinister movement. He reached behind him and flicked on the small lamp on the dresser, but still there was nothing to be seen. There was, however, plenty to be heard. Music played from somewhere deep in the house, and muffled voices and soft laughter mingled with it. Outside, the dog barked as if it were ready to attack and kill. Al turned the overhead light on, slipped on his pants, and went into the short hallway outside the bedroom, turning on lights as he passed the switches, his movements rapid and jerky. The music continued. The voices murmured on. Once again, there was only darkness downstairs. Al was halfway down when the sounds stopped. Silence. He felt a sharp pain in his hand, and realized it was because he was gripping the banister so hard. Outside, the dog continued to bark so hard that it was becoming hoarse. Al turned, went back up the stairs, into the living room. He switched on two lamps there, across the hall and into the dining room, where he froze. Someone was standing at the front window, looking out into the night. The blinds were raised and the figure was silhouetted in the dim moonlight that reflected off the snow. Al held perfectly still in the doorway, except for his hand, which crawled over the wall searching for the light switch as the figure turned and faced him. Al flicked the switch, filling the dining room with light as he sighed with relief.
Stephen.
Somebody's dog is, he chuckled, kind of carried away out there.
Were you playing music just now?
Stephen rubbed the back of his neck and started to walk slowly out of the dining room.
Music? No, I wasn't playing any music.
Al gently held his arm as he passed through the doorway.
You didn't have anybody in here? You didn't sneak some friends into the house?
Why? It's crowded enough in here as it is.
Al let go and the boy went down the hall, down the stairs. Later, Al would wonder about Stephen's words and how he had spoken them. They would bother him, even give him a chill when he recalled them. But for the moment, he took them only at face value. When Stephen was gone, Al went to the window and looked out at the dog. It looked like a lab and was closer to the house now, but seemed tense, ready to run if necessary. Much closer, and it would actually be biting the corner of the house. After lowering the blinds, Al went back to the bedroom, dressed, and went outside. He ran along the front of the house toward the dog, waving his arms and calling, "Get out of here! Get! Go! Beat it!" He threw, even kicked snow at the dog, but it was surprisingly difficult to tear the animal's attention away from the house. When he finally did, the dog hurried off, stopped and turned, whined a little, gave Al a few insistent woofs, then went away. Back inside, Al undressed, then stared at the bed a moment, wondering if it was safe to lie down again. He realized it didn't matter, because he was wide awake. In his robe, he went to the kitchen and opened the refrigerator.
"Damn, that's right," he whispered. "No beer."
He was still staring into the refrigerator's glaring light when the barking started again. Al slammed the refrigerator door. Glass clinked and cans rattled inside. He clutched his fists at his sides as the barking got closer, louder, more vicious. Eyes closed, breathing harshly through his nose, Al thought, "Boy, oh boy, sure could use a beer." In the living room, Al settled into his recliner. His thumb trembled as he used the remote to turn on the television. "Gonna have to talk to somebody about that damned dog," he breathed as he flipped through the channels. Its barking was relentless. He settled on an old Western and put the remote on the end table, where he spotted a rosary. Carmen kept them all over the house. He picked it up idly in his trembling hand, silently telling himself it wasn't necessary, that he wasn't upset, wasn't frightened, just restless, that was all. The dog went on barking and barking. Al whispered, "Hail Mary, full of grace. Barking. Barking." In the back of his mind, Al thought, but he wasn't quite sure because it was faint, so faint. He heard the tinny sound of music. Carmen returned 3 days later. Her father had been found in his small, run-down trailer. No bullet holes and a minimum of blood were found in the trailer, so it was presumed he was murdered elsewhere with his own .22-caliber pistol and brought back to his trailer. Although they didn't say as much, of course, the police seemed to think that finding the murderer was of little importance. After all, the victim had been an old drunk who barely subsisted, and who associated with the shadiest of characters, the kind of people most likely to do such a thing casually. Carmen and her brother made the burial arrangements, and because she wanted to get back home as soon as possible, she left Everett as the executor of their father's estate, what there was of it. She was glad to be home, and Al was glad to have her back. Everything had gone smoothly in her absence, he told her, but she had been missed. Everyone seemed fine, Al included, but somehow Carmen felt something was wrong. She couldn't put her finger on it. It was nothing visible, nothing anyone said. "Just my imagination," she told herself. After the last few days, everything looks pretty dark. They began the usual Christmas activities. Al brought home a tree, and Carmen and the kids, except for Stephen, decorated it. Al had taken Stephen to see Father Wheatley every day while Carmen was gone, and she kept it up after returning. She resisted the temptation to ask Stephen about his visits with the father, telling herself that the results would begin to show soon. But they didn't. Stephen was still rude and profane when he spoke, quiet and brooding when he didn't. If the talks with Father Wheatley didn't work, she hoped her prayers would. She wanted her son back. Carmen put a wreath on the door, some holly and garland here and there in the house, and brought out the records and tapes of Christmas music they'd collected over the years. She played the music often, kept eggnog in the refrigerator. Michael, Stephanie, and Peter made a snowman in the front yard, and Carmen gave them a broom and an old scarf and hat to put on him. They watched A Christmas Carol and It's a Wonderful Life again, as they did each year. They did all the things they did every Christmas, all the things that made them feel good, put them in the holiday spirit, and made that time of year different from any other. But this year, as Christmas neared, then passed, none of those things quite worked. It wasn't the same. Something was missing. Something other than Stephen's usual willing and cheerful participation. Carmen didn't know how the others felt, but no matter how hard she tried to work at it, it just didn't feel like Christmas. She didn't feel the way Christmas always made her feel. No matter how silly it sounded, Carmen simply did not feel safe. Not even in her own house. Perhaps especially in her own house. 13. The New Year Begins. Christmas decorations disappeared from store windows and were soon replaced with Valentine hearts and candy boxes. Strands of colored bulbs and sparkling garlands were boxed up and returned to storage. Christmas records and tapes were returned to their shelves, where they would stay until the following December. Trees were removed and dry pine needles were vacuumed from the carpet. All over town, naked, toppled Christmas trees lay waiting for garbage men to carry them away. Strands of tinsel and bits of garland still dangled from their brittle branches, sometimes blowing in the wind over the snow and ice. The sky remained a dark steel gray, and the air a blade sharp enough to slice fresh. The stripped branches of the trees reached skyward like arthritic claws. The snowflakes eventually turned to raindrops, and the snow on the ground became a thick, icy mud.
"We've been meeting for some time now, yet I don't feel as though I've really learned much about you. Why is that?"
"I don't know. Maybe because I haven't said much about me, you think?"
"Yes, I suppose. Why is that?"
Don't like talking about myself, I guess."
"I see. Well, would it be easier if I asked questions?"
"All you've been doing is asking questions."
"Yes, you're right. Well then, I guess I'm at a loss. You see, your mother asked me to speak with you a few months ago, I guess, because she was noticing what she thought were some unpleasant changes in you. So I agreed. For a while it was 5 days a week, then twice a week, down to once a week. All that time, I kept thinking that if I gave you a chance, you would tell me what was bothering you, what was wrong. Now I'm beginning to think that perhaps I was mistaken. Perhaps your mother was mistaken as well. So tell me, Stephen, were we mistaken?"
Stephen sat where he always sat in Father Wheatley's study, the way he always sat there, on the brown leather sofa, right foot dangling over his left knee, hands locked behind his head, elbows pointing upward on each side of his head like small wings. Father Wheatley sat in a straight-backed chair on the other side of the coffee table, in front of the sofa, facing Stephen. He was leaning forward, elbows on his knees, thin hands joined loosely. He was in his 50s, bald on top with a wreath of white hair around his head. He had glasses with brown tortoise-shell frames and thick lenses. He had a habit of removing them to pinch the bridge of his nose between thumb and forefinger. Stephen said,
"Were you mistaken about what?"
Father Wheatley did it again, removed the glasses, pinched the bridge of his nose, as he released a soft sigh.
"Oh, I'm not sure, really. Were we mistaken about there being something wrong with you? Tell me, Stephen, has something upset you lately?"
"How lately?"
"Well, anything at all."
"Yeah, cancer. That upset me."
His voice was not sarcastic. It remained low, level, and without expression.
"Of course it did. That's perfectly understandable. But our prayers have been answered. Your cancer is in remission, and you seem to be doing very well, physically, I mean. I'm talking about something that might have hurt your feelings. Something that might be making you angry or even scared. Is there something like that?"
Stephen's lower lip slowly moved inward until he held it between his teeth, nibbled on it slightly as his eyes moved gradually around the room, finally stopping, once again, on Father Wheatley.
"No," he said. No, nothing like that. I'm fine."
"You don't believe you've been behaving differently?"
He shrugged.
"I don't know. Different than what?"
"Different than usual?"
"Uh-uh. Not that I know of."
"What about the way you dress? Your clothes?"
"What about them?"
The slightest hint of defensiveness showed itself in his voice.
"Well, they're not the kind of clothes you usually wear, are they? I mean the jacket, for example. The t-shirts you wear around the house."
"T-shirts? What? You been talking to my mother?"
"Of course. She says you wear t-shirts with rock and roll groups and slogans on the front that are, well, offensive. Even blasphemous. Like your leather jacket."
"So? What's wrong with that? Lots of kids wear them.
But your mother says you never used to wear such things, or listen to such music.
He shrugged.
I do now.
Yes, but your mother seems to think the sudden change was brought on by, well, by something. Is that true? Did something happen that...
No. My friend Jason played his tapes for me one day. I liked the music. He gave me a couple old shirts, this old jacket. They just don't like it is all. The music, the clothes. So they're making like there's something wrong with me because of it.
Well, I must admit, Stephen, the jacket is blasphemous. The cross on your back is...
But there's nothing wrong with me. If that's why I've been coming here, then...
Another shrug.
I've been wasting your time. I'm sorry.
Father Wheatley looked at Stephen a long while, steadied his face through narrow, thoughtful eyes. Then,
would you like me to tell that to your mother?
I don't know. What do you think you should tell her? You're the priest.
Well, I suppose if you think these visits are a waste of time, then they are. If they stop, would you promise me something, Stephen?
A shrug.
If ever you need to talk to someone about something that, well, that you might not want to discuss with your parents or a school friend, will you come to me? I'd be happy to sit down with you any time.
Yeah, sure.
Stephen smiled.
I have to admit, Carmen, your boy is going through the throes of adolescence.
What do you mean, exactly?
Well, he's rebellious. He enjoys doing things that shock you, offend you. That's why rock and roll stars are able to make so much money without being talented,
he chuckled.
Because the kids know their parents don't like them.
But it's more than that, Father.
Carmen clutched the receiver tightly, pressed it hard against her ear.
He's changed his personality, his behavior. It's like he wants nothing to do with us anymore. He stays down in his room almost all the time. Only comes up to go to the bathroom or eat. He sits down there in the corner and mumbles to himself while he listens to that horrible music on headphones. He wears those shirts, that jacket, rings with little skulls on them. All that heavy metal paraphernalia. I don't even know where he gets it. Although I suspect it's got something to do with the boy he's been hanging around lately. Stephen is just not the same boy, Father.
Yes. It seems they all reach an age where they are no longer the same child. But some change more drastically. It sounds like that's the case here.
Yes, it is.
She closed her eyes and smiled slightly, relieved that he was finally beginning to understand.
Unfortunately, I didn't see any of that during my visits with Stephen. Oh, he was cranky now and then, a little impatient, but he was well-behaved. And yes, I noticed the jacket and the rings. I think your suspicions about Stephen's friends are correct. He mentioned a boy named Jason, who got him into the music. He sounds like a bad influence to me.
Tell me, Father, did he talk about our house at all? The house we live in here?
No. No, I don't remember him mentioning it at all. Why do you ask?
Oh, no reason. So, you don't think... I mean, there's nothing more you can do.
He laughed.
Carmen! Dear, I'm only a priest, but if you'd like, I can recommend a therapist.
Therapist?
Yes, a good Catholic therapist who specializes in this very situation. He works well with teens.
Carmen frowned.
A therapist?
Is that so bad? I think it would be a wise move.
Do you think Stephen is, well, you know... mentally ill?
Of course not, dear. I just think he's troubled. In fact, I suspect that a boy that age who isn't troubled is likely mentally ill. Growing up is a difficult project, and Stephen is going through some of the toughest times right now. In fact, he's had the added burden of his illness, something most teens don't have to deal with. No, Carmen, mental hospitals are for the mentally ill. Therapists are for people who've had a little too much dropped in their lap at one time. They're for people who are having trouble with the problems life hands all of us at one time or another. Therapists are for everyone. No, my suggestion of therapy does not mean I think your son is mentally ill, not at all.
Carmen could think of nothing to say. She did not agree with Father Wheatley, and that bothered her even more than her situation. So she just sighed quietly into the phone.
Do you have a pen, Carmen? Let me give you his name and telephone number. You call, explain the problem, and make an appointment for Stephen. If you'd like, you can make an appointment for the whole family. It's up to you.
Father Wheatley recited the name and number. Carmen did not write them down. Stephen decided to move into the room that had originally been his, but told no one except Michael. First he moved all of his things into the room, then, with Michael's help, moved the bed.
You sure you want to move over here?
Michael asked.
Yeah, why? I thought you didn't like this room. Oh, it's not so bad.
Michael frowned.
You didn't even like our room at first. Yeah, well, I guess I was stupid.
Michael's frown did not go away. Hands on his hips, eyes narrowed, he stared at his brother with concern.
It wasn't so stupid a while ago. Why the sudden change? I just want a room of my own. Is that so bad? You sure you're all right, Stephen?
Stephen laughed.
Why? Because you've been, well, kind of weird lately.
Another laugh.
You're starting to sound like them.
He jerked a thumb upward toward their parents upstairs.
Yeah, but I hardly ever see you anymore. You're always spending time with Jason. And you're always wearing them weird shirts and rings, listening to that music and... Oh, you're just too young yet. You'll be listening to that music, too. You'll wear these shirts because you like the groups. You'll see.
Michael's frown faded slowly. His mouth curled into a half smile.
You think so?
He asked.
Sure. Oh, well.
Michael shrugged.
Look at it this way. You've got your own room again. Yeah, but I kind of liked it when it was our room. You'll get over it,
Stephen chuckled. The month's bills were spread before Carmen on the dining room table, but her attention was directed toward one in particular. Carmen noticed that Al, he was seated at the end of the table to her left, was looking at the power bill, which she'd already seen. She watched his mouth become a tight, straight line, his eyes become wider and wider, his shoulders sag from shock, until he finally exploded.
Holy shit, have you seen this?
Carmen could only nod.
Son of a bitch, this is ridiculous. What have we been doing, lighting up the whole neighborhood?
He looked at her, mouth open, holding the bill out before him, waiting for an answer.
I think, she said hesitantly, it might be because of the lights being left on all night downstairs.
Are they still doing that?
He asked, his voice so low she almost couldn't hear them.
I think so.
He stood and slammed his fist onto the table hard. Carmen could hear his teeth grinding. He turned and left the dining room, turned right in the hall and started downstairs. Carmen got up and followed him, moving quickly, hoping her presence would keep him from getting too carried away.
Stephen! He called on his way down the stairs. Stephen, where... What the hell is going on down here?
Carmen reached the basement in time to hear Stephen explain that Michael was helping him move into his original room.
So? If you're not afraid to move into a room by yourself, why in the hell have you still been leaving the lights on all night down here?
Al bellowed. Stephen and Michael stared at him silently. Al held out the bill.
Look at this. The power bill. You want to count all the numbers in that little box at the bottom? You know why they're there? Because you've been leaving these goddamned lights on all night, that's why.
The boys said nothing.
Al jerked the bill back, slapping it against his thigh.
So, you know what I'm gonna do? I'll show you what I'm gonna do.
Moving as if he were in a terrible rush, Al first made his way through Michael's room, then Stevens, removing every single light bulb from every socket. He put them in an empty cardboard box he found in the corner of Stevens' room.
Please don't do this, Michael said quietly.
Nope, too late for that. You should have thought of that when you were leaving the lights on all night, running the power bill through the roof. Should have thought of it then.
But how are we going to do our homework?
Michael asked.
Do it upstairs.
Come down here when you're ready to go to bed. Holding the box under one arm, Al stood at the foot of the stairs and faced the boys.
No spending money or allowances for a while. We'll be going toward this goddamned bill.
Then he stomped up the stairs.
Well, boys,
Carmen said, folding her arms over her chest.
I don't know what to tell you. I think the law has just been laid down.
Michael sighed and bowed his head. Stephen just stared at her. He hadn't said anything so far. Just stared without expression, his face giving away nothing. Carmen shrugged and said quietly,
You should have listened to your dad in the first place.
He's not our dad,
Stephen said. His voice was low and flat. His lips had hardly moved as he spoke. Carmen jerked her head toward him, shocked. Stephen had never said such a thing before. He'd always called Al Dad. Always introduced Al to his friends as my dad.
You don't say much, Carmen breathed, but when you do, you sure know how to say something rotten, don't you?
Well,
Stephen shrugged,
he isn't.
I think that's about enough out of you, she said.
She turned to go back up the stairs, but stopped and turned to Stephen again.
If he's not your father, I'd like to know who is. Who's done everything for you that needed to be done over the years? Who's always taken you fishing? Who wanted to drop everything so he could be at your bedside while you were sick? And who was...
That doesn't make him my father,
Stephen said. His voice was a whisper, but he could not have hit her more forcefully with his hand. She'd thought for a moment that perhaps she was getting through to him, that maybe she was finally saying something that would work, that would stick, make him think. She realized, as she looked at his dull, expressionless face, that she'd been wrong. Carmen spun around and hurried up the stairs, hoping the boys had not noticed that she was crying.
You didn't have to say that,
Michael said angrily after their mother had gone. He stood at the foot of the stairs watching Stephen, who stood in his own room.
What? About Dad. It was a shitty thing to say. But it's true, isn't it? I mean, even if we call him Dad, that doesn't make him our dad, does it?
Michael cocked his head to one side and narrowed his eyes as he stared at his brother. One corner of his mouth turned up in a look of disgust, and he shook his head slowly.
What's wrong with you, Stephen? What's the matter with you?
Stephen's head tilted back slightly as he laughed.
I don't know. What's the matter with you?
Still laughing, Stephen reached out and closed the French doors. Michael heard his brother's muffled laughter continue as he stared through the glass and watched Stephen flop down on his bed. Al was deep in a calm, dreamless sleep, a rarity lately, when he was jerked awake suddenly. At first, he thought it was the bed again, but he was wrong. He sat up to find Michael standing beside the bed, in the dark.
I'm sorry,
Michael whispered.
What's the matter?
My light's on. In the bedroom. It woke me up.
Well, geez, Mike, turn it off.
Al started to lie down again, started to roll over, get comfortable, and go back to sleep.
But, Dad, you took out all the bulbs.
Al froze. He became alert suddenly when he realized that he had, indeed, taken out all the light bulbs downstairs earlier that night. Facing Michael again, Al whispered,
What do you mean, the light's on? It's on. It's shining.
Did you put a bulb in?
No.
Then Stephen must have...
There's no bulb.
Al turned to Carmen when she stirred and made a breathy noise in her sleep. When he was sure she wasn't going to wake up, he tossed the covers aside,
got out of bed and put on his robe. He followed Michael out of the room and into the hall. He was certain Michael had been dreaming. He was sure it was nothing more than that. He told himself it was nothing more than that, over and over as he followed the boy. As Al started down the stairs, he realized there was light down there. "Okay, come on, Michael, what'd you do? Take one of the bulbs from the drawer in the kitchen?"
"No," Michael hissed. "There's no bulb."
Al stopped halfway down the stairs. The back of his neck tingled, and he felt his stomach tighten, felt his testicles shrink upward into his body. Michael continued down the stairs until he realized Al was not following him. He stopped and looked back.
"Are you coming?"
Al's voice was dry and hoarse when he finally spoke.
"Yeah. Yeah, I'm coming."
He continued down the stairs, but much more slowly now, his hand clutching the banister as he went. Once at the foot of the stairs, he stood for a long moment in a pool of light shining from his left before turning to follow Michael into the bedroom.
"See?"
Michael said, his voice groggy.
"See what I mean?"
Al turned. His breath caught in his throat as if it were a rock. An empty light socket was glowing with a strong, off-white light that made Al squint. It was not a normal light, though. There was something very odd about it, something deeply unnatural. Al stared at the light, mouth open and working slightly, as if it were about to speak, but he said nothing, just stared at the glaring malignancy of the grayish-white light. The light disappeared and left them in darkness. Al pressed his lips together and took in a long, deep breath, then let it out slowly.
"See what I mean?"
Michael whispered. Al didn't speak for a while. He knew his voice would give him away. He hoped Michael had not looked at his face when he'd first come into the room.
"See what?"
he barked.
"The light. It was just..."
"It's pitch black in here, damn it. What light?"
The soft moonlight from the window glistened in Michael's wide, disbelieving eyes. He said nothing.
"What the hell is the matter with you? You wake me up in the middle of the night to just go to bed, goddammit. Go to bed right now."
Al spun away from Michael and hurried back up the stairs, clenching his fists so his hands would not tremble. In the bedroom, he removed his robe and sat on the edge of the bed and then shot back to his feet immediately, turning to look down at the bed. It was vibrating. Without realizing it, Al began to make small noises in his throat. He looked at Carmen and hoped, prayed, that she would not wake up as he backed away from the bed, leaned down for his robe, and hurried out of the room. In the kitchen, he turned on the light and opened a beer. He was halfway through it before he realized there were tears on his cheeks, and he was sobbing, quietly.
"You were right, you know,"
the voice whispered. Stephen lay in the dark, alone in his room, wide awake.
"He is not your father, is he?"
Stephen shook his head slowly on his pillow.
"He believes nothing you say. He has no faith in you, no respect for you. Does he, Stephen?"
He shook his head once again.
"Does he?"
"No,"
Stephen breathed.
"He will never do you any good, will he?"
"No."
"He will only prevent you from growing. Isn't that right?"
"Yes."
"He will only prevent you from becoming what I have promised you can become. Correct?"
"Yes."
"You do not want that, do you?"
"No."
"And why is that?"
"Because you've said so."
"And who am I, Stephen? Who am I that I should say so?"
"My father. You are my father."
"Who am I, Stephen?"
"You are God."
"That is right, Stephen. My son. That is right."
14. Winter into Spring. As the temperature outside the Snedeker house gradually rose and the gray of winter gave way reluctantly to spots of green here and there, the temperature inside dropped steadily, and the mood grew slacker. It was becoming more and more common for most of the conversation that took place in the house to be coming from the television, which was on constantly. None of them talked much anymore. They only ate around the dining room table on the weekends, and sometimes not even then. Instead, they put their plates on their laps or on TV trays. It wasn't as if they were angry with one another. That wasn't the case at all. Instead, it seemed as if they were preoccupied with their own private, silent thoughts, as if they were too busy going over and over things that disturbed them, examining them in their minds, gnawing on them. Stephanie and Peter were the only two people in the house who remained their usual playful selves, but even they seemed to notice the change and seemed a bit troubled by it. They also seemed to realize it would be best not to ask anyone what was wrong and, instead, spend much of their time together, playing and talking. Michael spent as much time as he could away from the house with friends. He used to hang around the house a lot with Stephen, but they were seldom together anymore. Stephen was his own company. He stayed downstairs when he was home, the electric squeals of his heavy metal music muffled by the closed and latched French doors. Sometimes he could be heard alone in his room, laughing. How did it happen? Carmen wondered one day. When did it start? When did we become like this? She sat at the desk in the sunroom, smoking a cigarette, trying to identify the point at which her family had changed. It was a subtle change, yes, but a definite change nonetheless. A chill had fallen over her home, over her family, and she was powerless to do anything about it. It made her feel almost as helpless as she'd felt when she'd learned that Stephen had cancer. Stephen. Sometimes she actually found herself missing him, as if he were away on a trip or something. It seemed as if he had gone away and been replaced by a stranger who roamed around the house ignoring everyone, smiling for no reason, sometimes mumbling to himself, sometimes laughing, wearing those horrible T-shirts with skulls and demons and desecrated religious symbols on them. He even looked like a stranger. His hair was growing longer and he seemed unconcerned about his appearance, and although she couldn't pinpoint the specific change that had occurred in them, even his eyes no longer looked familiar.
Al, don't you think we should do something about Stephen?
She'd asked a few nights ago as they were getting into bed.
Do what? I mean, what are we going to do? He's old enough to know how he's behaving. He knows what he's doing, so what are we going to do?
Al had changed, too. He'd become more quiet than usual lately, but when he did speak, he sounded as if he were on the very edge of anger, running his words together in a rush as if he were trying to get them out before they exploded inside him. He was drinking more, too, and his breath had smelled strongly of beer that night.
Well, what I mean is, she'd said, maybe he doesn't know what he's doing.
He's gotten weird, but he hasn't gotten stupid.
No, I mean, well, Father Wheatley suggested that maybe Stephen should get some therapy.
He barked out a couple of sharp, cold laughs.
Therapy? You know what that costs? An hour?
But if there's something wrong, it might be worth it.
If there's anything wrong, it's that damned kid he hangs around with, but you think he should be able to have his friends. You think that'll help him.
No, I don't believe in hiring somebody to do what a family should be able to do on its own.
Well, so far we haven't been about to do it on our own.
Oh, okay, so I suppose you think that's my fault or something.
I didn't say that. I'm just worried about him. There's something wrong with him, and I keep thinking there's something we should be doing. Mom said he's going through a stage, but she hasn't spent any time with him lately like we have. And how can this be a stage? He's just acting too weird. He's not even the same person anymore, and I don't think...
Well, I hope it is a stage,
Al said, rolling over and turning his back to her. And if it is, he'd better get through it fast. I'm going to kick his butt through it.
Carmen had lain awake for a long while that night, worrying about Stephen, and now she was worrying about him once again. But Stephen was not her only worry. There were the voices. They were never quite loud enough for her to be certain she'd actually heard, rather than imagined them. They were never quite identifiable either, though they always sounded familiar. Sometimes they whispered her name. Sometimes they laughed at her. At other times, she thought she could hear a small child calling her from somewhere in the house, when she knew she was alone. Still other times, their murmurings sounded angry, threatening. She still thought she saw things now and then, too, things that flittered around her quickly but were gone the moment she turned to them. Once, she'd hurried into her bedroom to get something from her dresser, and for just an instant, she could have sworn she'd seen a figure. It appeared to be a man, but it was impossible to tell. Sitting at the foot of her bed, but it was gone when she stopped and turned toward it. Then again, it could have been Willie skittering around the house, or a squirrel chattering in the backyard, or children playing in the neighborhood, or even her own troubled imagination, which was working overtime on the possibility that Stephen did need therapy, that perhaps he was mentally ill, that maybe his relationship with Al would never heal, that Al would just go on drinking until it became a real problem, and he was just as much a stranger to her as Stephen had become. And in the middle of all her worrying, she kept remembering Stephen's words on their first day in the house. "Mom, we have to leave this house. There's something evil here. Something evil. Something evil. Evil." Carmen needed someone to talk to. She'd tried talking to Al, but that hadn't worked. She used to be able to talk to Stephen about almost anything, but those days seemed to be over. Of course, there was always Tanya, if Carmen could get her to hold still long enough to have a conversation. Ever since leaving the house in such a hurry that one evening a few months ago, Tanya had kept herself busy enough so she wouldn't be able to talk at length with Carmen. For a while, Carmen had been hurt. Then she began to get angry, wondering why she was suddenly getting such chilly treatment from her friend. It was partially her fault, though, for not pinning Tanya down and talking with her. But she hadn't done that because she was afraid to talk with Tanya. Just before leaving, Tanya had said something about seeing things in the house, about the house making her uncomfortable. Carmen missed the time they used to spend together, the talks they used to have. But she didn't want to hear Tanya's explanation for what she'd said. She stood from the desk and went into the living room. Peter was in his bedroom napping. The others were still at school. She stood in the living room a moment, staring through the window at Tanya's house. How bad could it be? She wondered. What could she say that would be so awful? After checking on Peter to make sure he was still sound asleep, she went over to Tanya's. As soon as Tanya opened the door, Carmen said,
"Okay, let's sit down and talk." "Oh, hi, Carm. Gee, you caught me at a bad time. I was just going to..." "Really, Tanya, we need to talk. I need to talk. Please?"
Tanya stood in the doorway, chewing on a thumbnail.
"Something wrong?" "That's what I'd like to know. One day you run out of my house like it's on fire, and we've hardly talked to each other since. So, what's wrong? What happened?"
Tanya sighed and gave Carmen a sad smile.
"Yeah, I suppose we do need to talk. Come on in."
They sat at the small kitchen table, and Tanya poured them coffee. The baby was sleeping in the living room, and a talk show was playing low on a small AM radio on the table. For a few minutes, they made nervous small talk. Then Carmen asked her exactly what had happened that day she'd left the house so suddenly.
"I haven't said anything because, well, I knew how stupid I would sound," Tanya said hesitantly. "Said anything about what? If it'll explain why you hurried away that day without any explanation, I don't care how stupid it sounds, I want to hear it." "Well, your house. I was very uncomfortable in there. I didn't want to say anything because, well, because of what the kids had been telling you for so long, I knew how much that had bothered you, and you said you kept seeing things." "Yeah. In the corner of my eye, like someone or something was hurrying through another part of the room or the house, but there was no one there. And I felt I just didn't feel right. So you think the house really is?
Absolutely not. And that's exactly why I didn't want to say anything. I knew that you'd think that I thought that the house was haunted, and I don't, okay? I just think that...
When Tanya didn't go on for a moment, Carmen asked,
"What do you think, Tanya?"
She laughed nervously.
"Well, I'm not sure. It was probably just, you know, what you told me about what the kids had said and the history of the house, knowing what it used to be. That's all. I'm sure that's all."
Carmen thought about that a while, sipped her coffee, lit a cigarette.
"If that's all it is," she said, "then why don't you ever come over? Why have you been avoiding me?"
"Well, like I said, I was embarrassed, and I don't want to impose on you with the baby, and you know it's no imposition."
"The house just makes me uncomfortable, Carmen," she sighed. "That's all. It's stupid. It's childish. But I know what it used to be, and I think about what used to go on there, and it makes me uncomfortable."
"You're afraid of my house."
Tanya's sudden laughter sounded rather forced as she took her coffee mug to the sink and rinsed it.
"You are,"
Carmen said, following her.
"You're afraid of it."
"Carmen, please stop it."
"Well, what if I told you I feel the same way sometimes? What if I told you that I see things sometimes, that I hear voices sometimes, or that I..."
Tanya turned around suddenly and interrupted.
"You're joking, aren't you?"
"Not at all. Sometimes I think I'm going nuts over there. And Stephen, well, you say he's going through a stage, but it's a stage that didn't start until right after we moved into that house."
Tanya's eyes narrowed and she whispered,
"You really hear voices?"
Carmen nodded.
"So do you think the house is, you know, haunted?"
"I haven't let myself use that word yet, and I'm not sure I want to hear myself use it. But I'd be lying if I said it hadn't crossed my mind."
"What about Al?"
Carmen shrugged.
"We haven't talked about it. I don't know what he thinks, or if he has an opinion about it at all. I'm afraid he'd think I was nuts, and we've already talked about getting a therapist for Stephen, so one in the family's enough, thanks."
Tanya leaned against the bar that separated the kitchen from the dining room.
"So, what are you going to do?"
"What can I do? I can't talk to Al. And the last thing the kids need is for their mother to tell them the house is haunted. They've heard that enough from Stephen, but I had to tell somebody. That's why I came over. It feels good to, well, spill my guts."
"Makes me feel a little better, too,"
Tanya chuckled.
"At least I wasn't imagining things."
Carmen lit another cigarette.
"I don't know. Maybe it is just imagination. Things haven't been going well over there for any of us, that's for sure. I think everyone's kind of tense. I know I am. And like you said, the house does have a pretty strange background. That alone is creepy."
They were silent for a while. Voices droned through the ghostly static on the radio. Suddenly, Tanya drummed her fingers on the tabletop decisively.
"You ever listen to this show?"
she asked, nodding toward the radio. Carmen shook her head.
"I don't think so."
"I like it better than most talk shows because they get some really interesting guests most of the time. Really bizarre guests, you know? And just the other day they had a couple on who might be able to help you."
"Oh, what?"
Carmen laughed.
"Why would they be able to help me?"
"They're this married couple, see, the Warrens. And they're, well, ghostbusters, I guess. Only for real. None of that Bill Murray stuff."
She laughed.
"You're kidding, right?"
"No. No, really. That's not the first time I've heard of them, either. I read an article that..."
She snapped her fingers and stood.
"In fact..."
She left the kitchen and Carmen heard her shuffling around in the living room. When she returned, Tanya was paging quickly through a magazine. Once she was seated, she found what she wanted, folded the magazine open, and slapped it down on the table.
"There they are,"
she said, pointing to a photograph. Carmen picked up the magazine and studied the man and woman on the page, half her mouth curling up in amused disbelief.
These people? You mean these people are, she laughed, Ghostbusters? But they look normal.
They are normal. You should hear them. They're perfectly normal, pleasant, intelligent, very un-nuts.
The man and woman in the picture wore broad smiles. Both in their 60s, the man, stocky and barrel-chested, had graying hair and wore metal-rimmed glasses, and the woman had sparkling eyes and dark hair that was drawn back in a bun. They looked pleasant, warm, like someone's favorite set of grandparents. The caption read, "Demonologists Ed and Lorraine Warren reside in Connecticut, but travel extensively to lecture and continue their research."
"You can take it, if you want," Tanya said. "It's a real interesting article. They talk about all the signs of a haunting, you know, like sudden changes in temperature, things moving around the house by themselves or disappearing, flashing lights, ghost lights, they call them, and all kinds of stuff. They say that children and animals are usually the first to notice because they're really sensitive to things like that, you know. They tell stories about some of the cases they've worked on, too, and they..."
"Children and animals?"
Carmen asked quickly.
"Huh? Oh, yeah, they sense those things a lot better than adults."
Carmen frowned and stared at her hand on the table.
"Children and animals."
She thought of Stephen insisting from the very beginning that there was something wrong with the house. And of...
"That dog,"
she whispered to herself.
"Huh? What dog?"
"Oh, just... remember that dog that was barking outside almost every night for a while?"
"Oh, you heard him too, huh? Yeah, I thought I'd go crazy. Why?"
"Al finally wandered around the neighborhood one day a few weeks back until he found out who owned it and told them to keep it locked up at night. But it barked outside our house every night. It stood at the front corner on this side and barked like it was about to attack the wall."
Tanya cocked her head and frowned.
"Really?"
"Yeah, it only woke me a couple times. I can sleep through just about anything most of the time. So I only saw it twice, but Al, it woke him up every time, I guess. Said it always stood right there, barking, at the house."
Tanya wore a troubled expression as she stared thoughtfully at Carmen for a while. Then she tapped a finger on the picture of the Warrens and said,
"I think you should call them."
"Call them? Why? I mean, what would I say? I was just..."
She laughed.
"Just making an observation is all."
"What could it hurt? They just live over in Monroe. They have a museum there at the house. They hold lectures and teach classes there on demonology and, well, it's all in the article. Take it, read it. You could at least ask them what they think of your situation."
Another laugh.
"You know what Al would do if he knew I called a couple of Ghostbusters to tell them our house might be haunted? He'd pitch a fit."
"He doesn't have to know, does he?"
She scanned one column of the article, thinking.
"No, I don't think so. I'm sure this just, well, I've been stressed out lately, and it's just me, Tanya, just us. Things are pretty tense with us these days, that's all."
"Is anything wrong?"
"Oh, nothing serious. I don't think, anyway."
"Well, at least take the magazine with you and read the article."
"Yeah, sure. Sounds interesting."
Carmen did take the magazine home with her, but instead of reading it, she dropped it on top of a stack of other magazines beneath an end table in the living room. But she did not forget about it. Not quite. Carmen was not the only one who had been giving a lot of thought to what Stephen had said that first day in the house. Al had been haunted by the boy's words, haunted the way the ghost of a murder victim might haunt its killer, with cruel and dogged persistence. So he drank more. He was aware of it, and he didn't like it, but he didn't know what else to do. Sleep did not come easily at night, and neither did waking up in the morning. It was difficult keeping his mind on his work during the day, and when he got home in the evening, he was almost too wound up and run down just to hold the simplest conversation. So some beers seemed to be the best solution. All because of some phantom music at night, a damned barking dog,
until a couple weeks ago anyway. Vibrations in the bed and Stephen's claim that the house was evil, combined with what the house used to be. And, of course, there were the disturbing changes in Stephen. Al didn't even like to look into the boy's eyes anymore. They were the cold eyes of a threatening stranger, and they made Al's neck hairs bristle. It wasn't just his eyes, though. The sound of his laughter coming up the stairs when he was alone in his room was unnerving, and his quiet mumblings as he walked along the hall. He didn't even spend as much time with Jason as he used to, and they had been inseparable. Jason still came over. They still went downstairs together and listened to that music. Sometimes Al caught them exchanging glances or whispering to one another in a way that made him think they shared some unhealthy secret. One evening, the whole family had been watching television in the living room when Stephen had surprised them by coming in and joining them. He sat on the floor in the corner behind them and folded his knees up against his chest. No one said anything to him. They just exchanged quick, surprised glances, then turned their attention back to the television. Then he'd started mumbling to himself. They'd ignored it at first, although Al had found that very difficult, but it continued. His words were indistinguishable, his voice a low, throaty drone, punctuated occasionally by a soft chuckle. All the while, his distant eyes remained locked on the television screen. Al's right hand began to squeeze the bottle of beer tighter and tighter, until...
"Will you stop that goddamned mumbling?"
Al shouted.
"What the hell is wrong with you? You're acting like a crazy person, a sick person. Now will you shut the hell up or go to your goddamned room?"
Everyone else in the room had stiffened at Al's shouting. Stephen just sat there a few moments longer, stared at the television and continued to mumble to himself. Then he stood and said quietly,
"Okay."
He left the room without looking at anyone, his lips twitching into an icy smirk as he passed Al. They heard his footsteps as he went down the stairs, his footsteps and his quiet laughter. Al hated it, Stephen's mumblings, his own shouting, but he didn't know what to do about it and had no idea where it had come from. It was so foreign. Their family had been so quiet and content before. He kept hoping that it would pass, that it would just go away, and things would be as they had always been. Until then, he would do his best to ignore it. The day Carmen had talked with Tanya about the house, Al came home from work feeling the way he usually felt, wrung out. He was looking forward to a good dinner and a few relaxing beers. That was not what awaited him. When he walked through the front door, he heard Carmen crying. He stepped into the dining room to find her seated in one of the chairs from the dining room set. It had been turned to face the doorway to the kitchen. She was leaning forward, elbows on her thighs, chin resting in her palms with her hands over her cheeks, as she stared into the kitchen and sobbed.
"Carm?"
She jerked upright and cried out in shock.
"What's the matter?"
he asked, unable to hide his annoyance. Trying to catch her breath, she wiped her eyes, then pointed into the kitchen. She tried to speak, but only sobbed again. Al walked over to the doorway and looked into the kitchen. White chunks of crockery were scattered over the floor amid a pool of dried, sticky-looking, maroon-colored juice and thick chunks of some unidentifiable substance that appeared to have crawled over the linoleum.
"What happened?"
Al asked.
"Willie. He was out and I didn't know it. He got up on the counter and knocked over the pitcher of juice and my casserole."
Al sighed and put his arm around her.
"Well, why are you so upset?"
"That's no big deal, is it? I mean, it's just... well, it's just a mess, right? It could be cleaned up." She looked up at him slowly. Her mouth was curled downward, lips pressed hard together.
"Okay, then you clean it up," she shouted. "You mop that fucking floor. See what it does to you."
Al took a step back, his mouth hanging open.
"What? That floor. You just go ahead and see what... No, I'll show you myself."
She stood.
"You just watch. Just watch."
She shot from the chair and left the dining room. Al stood beside the chair looking confused. Was Stephen's craziness catching?
what was happening to his family. In a few minutes, Carmen returned with the mop and a bucket full of water. She kicked off her shoes and bent down to roll up her pants.
"Now you just watch," she said.
Still looking as though he'd been slapped in the face for no reason, Al watched as Carmen began to mop the kitchen's red brick floor. Michael, who had heard his mother's shouting, joined him. So did Stephanie and Peter. They watched as Carmen mopped. They watched as the mop turned a dark color. They watched as her bare feet began to slop through a reddish-brown liquid that formed quickly on the linoleum. And they smelled the coppery odor. Carmen was still crying, stopping now and then to wipe away her tears with the heel of her hand. After a while, she stopped and turned to Al, ignoring the children.
"You see this?" she shouted. "This